Welcome back to the program. We know that Amazon has vast amounts of data on our purchases and that it uses it in order to recommend products to us, just as Netflix recommends our movies. But imagine aggregating millions of files of medical data with genomic data so that our genetic profile can, with a high degree of probability, tell us what diseases we might get and how to treat them. Think about how Google was able to head off a worldwide flu pandemic by aggregating vast amounts of search data. The kind of data that can tell us when we will be sick, even before we know it, or when our car will need service, even before it breaks down. Or, as in the movie Minority Report, data that can predict who will be a criminal, even before the crime is committed. These are just a few of the things we should be thinking about with respect to what's referred to today as big data. My guest today, Ken Cukier, has been looking at these issues for many years as the data editor of The Economist and as a prominent commentator on the developments in the world of big data. Now he's the co-author of a new book entitled Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. Ken Cukier, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
It's good to have you here. When we look at the amount of data that's being collected today, the numbers are overwhelming, that the amount of data that's out there, which is pretty substantial even as we sit here, is doubling every 3 years. Talk a little about that first.
Yeah, sure. So we like to think that we live in the information society and that we've been doing it for a long time. People may remember the dot-com bubble in 99. Launch of Windows 95, which was a watershed moment for computing in 1995 and elsewhere. But that's really not true when you think about it, looking at it in a historical sense. And here's the riveting number, that the amount of analog information and digital information was actually at parity around the year 2002. So in fact, around the year 2000, 1999, it was really about one-fifth digital and four-fifths analog. And analog means everything from printed material to vinyl LP records, cassette tapes, engravings in the stones of the Temple of Delphi, all of it. However, because digital information grows just so quickly, doubling, as you say, in only a few years, the amount of digital information swamped the amount of analog information. So right now, the world has 1.2 zettabytes of information. That means a lot, generally speaking. But what it really means is that 98% of the world's information is digital, only 2% is analog, and that's going to, of course, just winnow and winnow and winnow until it's infinitesimally small. So where's all the data coming from? Well, just think about, as you said in your introduction, genomics, right? The DNA sequencing. It took the world about at least a decade, and it took $3 billion to sequence the human genome, which is about 3 billion base pairs. We now can do that in just a matter of days, and we can do it for just a few $1,000. It shows that the entire world has shifted in terms of the data deluge. We are now swamped with information like never before. That's the bad news. The good news is we can do great new things with it like never before, too.
One of the fundamental differences that you talk about in the book, Big Data, is that for so long data was used to either confirm or deny information. Now data essentially has a mind of its own, comes to conclusions on its own when it is aggregated properly.
A way of thinking about that is take the case of sales receipts. In the past, we would look at, we'd collect the transactions from a cash register, and we would learn something when we aggregated that information, and the information about sales receipts would tell us something about sales. Okay, so a few years ago, Walmart peered into its big databases, and they noticed an interesting correlation that the amount of Puff Tarts would sell a lot whenever there was a storm. So they knew, essentially, to put the Pop-Tarts next to the storm supplies because there was a good correlation. Now, we don't know why that's the case. We simply know that's an interesting correlation, and they could act on it. Seems to me that if there's a blackout, that the kids are going to be mollified without television for the night. That might be the reason. But either way, what we are now able to do is use vastly more streams of data to learn brand new things that we couldn't know before, where, as you say, the data sort of informs us in ways that it couldn't before. And one example is research looking at how to identify cancerous cells. In the past, we have someone take the biopsy as a lab technician and try to identify it with known traits of what would be cancerous and what's not. We look at it and we find it, and it works, right? Of course, it's expensive and it's time-consuming. So what we try to do is we try to train a computer to do this through what's called computer vision, and it's very good. They're very good at picking these things out. And if we give them the known features of what a cancerous cell is, it can match it against it, and it does a fairly good job. It's not as good as a human being, but it's still not bad. So you, as a first screening test, it's okay. But then what we do, which was an incredible finding, is we just gave it a lot of data, vastly, vastly more data, and didn't give any presumption of what is cancerous or what is not, but we let the computer try to infer what is a cancerous cell and what is not, based on the outcome, based on, if you will, all the data from training data. Right then what happens is not only do they spot the things, the traits of cancerous cells that the human beings knew to look for that were cancerous, but they spotted things that we didn't even know to look for. Okay? So this is getting a little bit spooky, but indeed, we now found out that, in fact, where human beings were looking at the cells themselves, the computer identified that there was an interesting pattern of the spatial distance between cells. We never thought to look there before, something called a stroma. So it shows that when you have a lot of data, instead of it being an encumbrance, if we use it cleverly, it becomes part of the solution.
One of the things you talk about is that in gathering all of this data, in there being so much of it, that the process is at once messier and yet more interesting in so many respects.
That's right. So why should we care about messiness? Well, in a small data universe, we had only a little bit of data. So we had to make sure that the information that we did collect was as pristine and clean as possible. Because if not, a small error in our measurement was going to lead to a huge outsized error when we try to extrapolate from that small sample to the whole. When we have a lot more data, we can give up not our interest in messiness, we would still like clean data, but we can give up our singular devotion to it. It's no longer the be-all and end-all of the way that we process information. So an example of this is machine translation. So the way that statistical machine translation works, things like Google Translate, is it looks for the probability that a word in one language is the best fit for another word in another language. And it's just a game of probabilities. It's just math. So it might look at the word light in English, and it would choose between lumière and légère in French, which would be, you know, illumination or the lack of heaviness, right? Light. And so it's going to look at the context that the word is in, and it's going to choose one versus the other. That's great. Now, when engineers tried to do this with a small database, or a small amount of data that was very clean and highly curated and very pristine, it worked, but it didn't work very well. Google then availed themselves of many orders of magnitude more data because they just chose it from the World Wide Web. It was no longer sort of groomed by hand. And now what happened is the data was a lot more messy because it was, you know, there were misspellings. It was from flotsam and jetsam of the Internet. The optical character recognition reading software didn't get the word exactly correct. Nevertheless, because they had vastly more data, their translation service was much, much better. So if you will, the lesson here, not in all cases, but in this one, and many other classes of problems, that more, less clean data trumps less, cleaner data.
It seems to always come back to, in the story you just told, in the flu tracking that went on back in 2009, is that Google oftentimes seems to be at the center of all of these discussions.
Yes. Interesting that, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Google is a powerhouse. Google is unlike any other company I think we've ever seen in history. They are, I mean, or you have to think of it in terms of Ford in the early stages of the 1900s, or the East India Trading Company. They understand data and the importance of data like no one else. It is true that today many other companies are sort of catching on to it and seeing it. But the point here is that they saw it 15 years ago, and they have executed brilliantly on it. Whenever they collect data, they don't collect it for one purpose. They collect it for multiple purposes. So we used to think of their Street View cars as taking photographs of the road. How quaint, right? No. The Street View cars was collecting huge streams of data on lots of different things. Just the direction it was going into, the GPS, what was on the street, whether it was a stop sign or whether it was a traffic light, all were very important. Yes, they used it not just for maps, but for the photographs, but also for maps. But they used it as the basis of their self-driving car, right? So they have outdone Detroit by having a self-driving car because they're using data and predictive algorithms. And Street View was a part of that. They were collecting data for multiple purposes, not just one. This is very interesting. They have built their entire company around a new resource, a new raw material, a new economic input. It's data. They treat every single interaction with the company and their website as a signal to something else. What does that mean? So here's how it works. Whenever you go to Google and you type something in, they look at where you're clicking. And if you're clicking at, say, if lots of people are clicking on the eighth link on the first page, the algorithm learns. It knows that it's more relevant to people, so they move it up the ranking. It'll be the first or second. Very few other companies have that sort of intellectual idea that they can learn from users' interaction in every single domain and parlay that back into an improved service. They're collecting, if you will, value from the user that they recycle into their system and become more valuable as a company.
You referred to it a few minutes ago as raw material. The data has really become or is becoming the raw material of the information age.
Absolutely. And we see this again and again. And the great thing about information is that it's a non-rivalrous good, as we say in economics, which is to say that one person's usage of it doesn't diminish another person's. Other, for example, in an infrastructure like a bridge, if you go over it, the bridge deteriorates slightly, and I can't drive where you're driving. But with an information good, we can both share it with at very low marginal cost of sharing. So what we're seeing right now is that the data has not just one use, the use for which it was collected, the primary purpose, but in fact a myriad of secondary uses with which it can be put that is really limited just by people's imagination.
In fact, some of the conclusions that can be reached from aggregating and analyzing all this data is sometimes counterintuitive to what our hunches might lead us to or what we might think ordinarily without the data.
That's right. We see that in healthcare, and there's a lot of fabulous research going on to care for premature babies. It's being done by a woman named Dr. McGregor in Canada. And what she has done is she has taken the 16 real-time streams of vital signs of premature babies and looked for correlations and patterns. And so she's looking at things like respiration, pulse, temperature, blood oxygen level. Altogether, it's 1,000 data points per second. And when she puts it all together, she can spot the onset of infection 24 hours before the infection symptoms actually take hold. So you can treat the baby sooner with less dosage of medication and respond to it quicker and save lives. Now, that's great. Among the findings that she's seeing in an early stage is that the best predictor that a child is about to have an infection is not that the vital signs start to go haywire. No. In fact, it looks as if the vital signs start to stabilize. Now, you can imagine generations of doctors at 7 p.m. checking their watch, seeing the vitals of a baby start to stabilize and think that it's safe to go home. Just tell the nursing station, call me if there's a problem. And then at midnight getting a frantic call that something had gone tragically wrong. Now, we can identify that what the best predictor is, and we can actually act on it. We don't necessarily know why, right? It's just simply a correlation. Maybe the little kid's organs are battening down the hatches for a rough ride ahead. But what's certain is that we can parlay these insights, even these counterintuitive insights, into actionable decisions that we can make.
You just touched on something that's critical about this, is that the why becomes less important than the what is.
Well, that's right. It's not always going to be the case, but in lots and lots of cases, that's what's happening. That just simply having the correlation and acting on it allows us to get things done in our day-to-day life. Now, for many things, we still want to know what's behind it. So we might want to know the biological mechanism. It might help us in lots of other ways. If we're creating a drug that we need approval for, knowing the biological mechanism might be essential. Now, I say might because it might not be. It depends on what it is we're trying to do. Of course, aspirin, we do know how it works, but we don't know how it works perfectly. If we did, we'd know why it sometimes doesn't work. So aspirin is sort of one of these classes of medications that we sort of go forth and yonder, and multiply, but we don't actually have a great understanding of. And weirdly, the thing about big data is we're learning that from more and more situations and phenomenons in the world, what we think we know in terms of causal connections, we actually don't. We come up pretty closely. We jump up against the limitations of our knowledge because the system is so complex. But what we do know is that with big data, by finding these correlations, we can actually put aside our preference for causality and just go with a correlation. And if it fits, run with it.
What this leads to, as you talk about in the book, is and where it seems to be heading in so many aspects of society right now, is the literal datification of everything.
Yes. So the term datification is one that we coin in the book, and we asked ourselves, what is going on here? On one hand, what we're seeing in society is we're collecting more data than ever before on things that we always collected data about. But we're also collecting data on new areas of things that were always, if you will, informational, but never had been rendered in a data format before. And of course, once it's in a data format, we can store it, share it, analyze it, process it, and learn from it in new ways. So an example, if you will, would be, say, sitting posture. The way that you sit and the way that I sit are different. It depends on our weight. It depends on the distribution of our weight and the common distribution. It depends on our leg length. And if you can imagine that if we put 100 sensors underneath our chair, we would be able to identify how you sit and I sit and everyone else, and probably identify almost like a fingerprint that two people sit exactly the same way. So if we put it into a car, we would be able to have, for example, an anti-theft device. We would know if an unapproved driver were driving the car, and we could maybe conk out the engine if that's the case. Or if you have a teenage child, you might want to say you're not allowed to drive after 8 p.m. The car would know and police it and, like Cinderella, turn into a pumpkin. So that's pretty interesting. But what if we had 100 million cars on the road that all had this instrumentation and we dataized posture? Well, suddenly we might be able to find out the telltale signs of shift in posture prior to an accident, maybe 30 seconds before an accident occurs. And what we would have done, if you will, is datafied driver fatigue. And now the service would be we would have the car send an internal alert to the driver, like a chime, or maybe the steering wheel would vibrate to say, hey, wake up, you know, shift to posture again, we need you to be more alert.
The other side of this, of course, is that this is data that is being collected all the time, in many cases without our knowledge. And there are great concerns about privacy, and what people see is the dark side of all of this data, as well as all the positive benefits we've been talking about.
That's right. It's a problem in a small data universe. It is a bigger problem in a world of big data. One of the reasons for the changes is that in the world of big data, some of the tools that we've used to police privacy and to protect it are no longer as effective. So the technical tools break down because what we tend to do to police and protect privacy today is something called anonymization, which we have a huge database of people's names, say it's their medical records, so we simply strip out the details of who these people are, their names. Not good enough anymore, but because with big data we can make interesting correlations that we couldn't before, what was previously not personally identifiable now can be. A simple example is the way that we sit, right? Or you can imagine the way that we walk. We would never have thought that our smartphones that have lots of sensors in them might identify who we are just by the way that we carry it. But of course, we probably carry it in a predictable way. It's at a known elevation because we tend to put it in the same place when we're walking around. Every two people walk differently. Their gait can be measured, and again, it's in terms of their leg length and their stride. And suddenly, what doesn't seem to be personally identifiable can be. Right? So that's a problem. And then the second tool is a technical one, and that is, is a policy one, and it's legal, and it's called notice and consent. Typically, the way that we protect privacy is that companies have to give notice about what they're collecting and using, and individuals have to give their consent. And it's looking more and more farcical. You can imagine that when you download an app and it asks to approve the terms and services, it wants you to look at a contract, and the contract might be 60 screens long, written by a lawyer, all in capital letters, and the temptation is just to click, I have read the terms and services and I agree to them, and move on to Angry Birds. That's the way the world works today. It doesn't seem like it's a very sufficient legal mechanism that protects either companies and what they like to do or individuals, so we probably need to think of something new.
The other side of it, of course, is the degree to which we tend to give too much credit, or we might give too much credit and value to all of this data, or as you guys talk about it in the book, that we start to fetishize data, essentially.
That's right. Again, it's a problem that's not unique to big data, but it's going to be a bigger problem with big data, because as more aspects of our lives become datafied and that we rely on data for more things, the temptation to sort of turn off our thinking and trust the system is going to grow ever greater. And we have to make sure that we keep our common sense and our judgment. We've seen even at Google, they have taken trusting data to crazy extremes. They used to ask many of their executives, including senior executives that they were recruiting, what their SAT score was and what their grade point average was at university. And this was the belief that the one showed aptitude and the other one showed accomplishment or achievement. Now, this was ridiculous. You had 45-year-old senior executives being recruited by the company, being asked what their SAT scores were and getting their transcripts for their GPA. They were bewildered. They couldn't understand what was going on. Google's own in-house study showed that there was no correlation between these two data points and performance on the job, yet the HR team still asked for it. It was crazy. And, of course, in American history, tragically, we've even experienced that as well. The Vietnam War was a complex one, and the way that we fought it and thought about it and the internal debates was deep and tragic. But one of the aspects of it was the idea of body count, right? McNamara waged his war in large part, based on statistics, trusting the spreadsheets and not really understanding that it couldn't reflect truly what was on the ground. I do fear less a world of Orwell and more a world of Kafka, the bureaucracy taking data and running with it in a ways that we as the citizens don't fully agree with.
One of the things that's clear, though, is that at least up to this point, that big business and government still don't get it, that they really don't have a sense of how important and complicated all of this could be.
Well, they're getting it quicker and quicker. And also, business and government, I don't think, are any one thing, right? So you have people at the White House who drink the Kool-Aid in terms of big data, understand its importance. In some ways, the U.S. government was one of the pioneers of big data because they participated in the Human Genome Project through the funding of the National Health Services and other early-stage research in biomedicine. So there's parts of the government that fully do deeply understand what's to play for. And you would actually have a lot more casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan were it not for big data. They used past information on explosions of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, to know where to send troops to make it the safest route possible. So parts of the government, particularly the military, are already using these techniques for good effect. Same with business. Of course, Google has been a company that's outperformed others, and Amazon, no question, because they learn from data. But it's true that it has not been fully, we're not fully steeped in it as a society. The good news is that we're getting there, and me and my co-author are proud to have written the book that sort of sets that out so that many people from all aspects of society, not just the professional, can think about these issues in a profound way.
Kenneth Cukier, he's the co-author of Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. Ken, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.